Hello and welcome to the Pirate Party Australia webcast, dedicated to the discussion of freedom of information and culture, government transparency and civil liberties in the internet age. I'm Sam Kearns and this is episode number one for Saturday, 14th of April, 2012. This week on the Pirate Party Australia webcast, we begin a four-part series on the history of copyright and also talk to Simon Frew, Deputy President of Pirate Party Australia, about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. On April 5th, Pirate Party Australia made a press release expressing disgust at reports that the United States plans to cancel the stakeholder program for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Simon Frew, Deputy President of Pirate Party Australia, gave a presentation at a stakeholders' meeting in Melbourne last month, where he criticised the lack of transparency surrounding the TPPA negotiations. I've invited Simon Frew onto the webcast today to tell us more. Thanks for joining me, Simon.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay, to begin with, tell me more about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement itself. What exactly is it?
Well, it was a free trade treaty originally between Chile, Malaysia and a few other small countries that has since expanded to include Australia, the US, a lot more countries that have turned up.
So why do we want to be involved in it? Like,
well,
is this just one of those things where it's like, because we're allies, you know, it's just kind of expected?
I think that's partly it, and also partly that there are a lot of sort of benefits that Australia can get through getting actual free trade treaties. The problem with the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is that a lot of what the US are pushing for is not the sort of thing you get in a traditional free trade treaty. It's more of a wish list for major corporations, particularly corporations that are interested in intellectual property issues like pharmaceutical companies and the record industry.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, there's a lot of other stuff in the TPPA that's, you know, not specifically, you know, about copyright and patents. And I guess, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, they're trying to sort of slip this in along with everything else.
Yeah, well, a lot of what, like, the Australian negotiating positions are actually seem fairly reasonable. They want to make qualifications more accepted from country to country so people can get jobs, go to different countries and get jobs easier, and, you know, consistent standards for stuff like that. A lot of what the US is pushing for, even more broadly than IP, is pretty much as bad as the IP section. I don't know as much about it, but it seems to be a lot of stuff like making, if a government passes laws affecting the profitability of a corporation operating in that country, they'd have to reimburse that company that had lost profits or the projected lost profits. So stuff like that, which the US has had on the agenda of various free trade agreements for years. Like, so it's not just IP where they're pushing for a lot of terrible stuff, but the IP stuff is particularly bad. And it's,
Yeah, so that's pretty worrying. I mean, the idea that they could, you know, push this idea that, you know, we can't pass a law that might possibly hinder the profits of a US corporation or else, you know, we have to pay. I mean, that's kind of like an end run around sovereignty, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is indeed. It's one of those things where I think when the original IP chapter was leaked, a lot of people said about that that the US leaked it themselves so they could get something not so extreme but still get like what they see as like progress on the issues. So it's probably the same with stuff like this as well, where they're arguing for an extreme position so people will come back from there and they'll still get a lot of what they want.
Yeah, I've heard about that kind of thing being done. What was it, the daddy buy me a pony tactic?
Yeah.
You know, where the daughter says, "Daddy, buy me a pony. And he says, "No." And then she says, "Okay, will you buy me a dog?" And he goes, "Yes," thinking that, you know, he's got out of it easily, and then, you know, the daughter thinks, well, that was the easiest dog I ever got.
Yeah.
So, anyway, moving on, how does the stakeholder program fit into the TPPA negotiations? I mean, who came up with this, and what was it supposed to do?
I'm not entirely sure which countries were really pushing for it, but a number of countries involved in the negotiations have pushed for it. There are a few countries that, like particularly the USA, but also some of the less democratic countries sort of didn't really want civil society involved in the negotiations. I think Australia's pushed for more involvement, which is a good thing. But, yeah, this was the meeting in Melbourne was the first time that civil society had been invited to the negotiations, and it seems the last now.
Yeah, do you think the US was ever actually serious about the stakeholder program, or was this just a token effort from the get-go that got canned as soon as it looked like it, you know, they weren't hearing what they wanted to hear out of it?
I think they didn't want it at all, and they had it as a kind of response to a lot of pressure applied to them from a lot of the other countries involved in the negotiations, and they... it didn't go well for them, and that would be why they really pushed to not have any more. Like, the next round was originally to be held in Chile, and now it's moved to the USA. And a lot of people think that's just so they can exert more control over the entire process.
Yeah, well, that's what I just thought of that when you said it. I thought, well, obviously, if it's in the US, they can take greater control of it. So what's going to happen going forward now? Is the TPPA now just going to be all behind closed doors and freedom of information requests results in redacted documents and things like that?
Yeah, it seems that way. There is a stakeholder meeting alongside the negotiating round in the US, but there's no space for presentations, and, yeah, it's unclear exactly what any use would be in going. Possible chance to speak to negotiators, I suppose, but that's about it, really. There's no information of what's actually being negotiated. It's pretty hard to go and comment about it, a treaty.
All right. Was there anything else you wanted to say about it?
Well, talk more about the actual, some of what they're actually trying to do, what the US wants.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Well, a lot of the dodgy stuff in terms of the intellectual property section, there's sort of two strands of main sort of areas of concern. One's the for patents, in particular medicine, where they have basically they want to clamp down on generic medicines, and includes provisions for border seizures of any medicines suspected of breaking a patent in any of the signatory countries. It would have a massive impact on, like, health in a lot of third world countries, particularly signatory countries like Vietnam has a large generic medicine industry, which they give to sell cheaply to other poor countries. That would become a lot more difficult industry to run under the agreement.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the areas where there's a real moral issue at stake. Regarding, you know, because if someone's got a patent, that means that, you know, even complete independent invention is sort of disallowed. So if a US company has a patent on a drug, but, you know, a third world country completely independently invents the same or similar drug, I mean, they're prevented from doing their own research for their own people, so that they can, yeah, make drugs that are in their own country at a price that they can afford. And then, you know, US companies just sort of wave their patent around, which is supported by the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and people in that third world country are completely priced out of being able to afford such medicines, and then suffer real hardship and possible death.
Yeah, yeah. Jordan signed a free trade agreement with the US, which included such clauses in that, and they found that medicine went up by about 40%, according to Medicine Sans Frontieres, and a lot of their health programs just had to be cut because they just didn't have the money to run them anymore. This is also true in Australia when we signed a free trade agreement with the US with the public benefit health system, where some medicine, although Australia negotiated it back from what the position was with Jordan, it still put up the prices of a lot of medicine here, at least to the government who covers it through the PBS.
Yeah, and I mean, even for us, it's not good. But yeah, for those third world countries, it could be catastrophic.
Yeah, it's life or death for them.
Yeah. I mean, and here with the, you know, the pharmaceutical benefits scheme and things like that, it just means that, you know, we have a bigger tax bill.
Yeah.
Effectively.
Yeah, and then there's all, besides the pharmaceutical stuff, which is quite bad, there's also all the anti-piracy proposals that include basically the wording of what they consider commercial file sharing is so vague so as to include, well, non-commercial file sharing, like someone using torrent software, that would be considered commercial according to the wording of the agreement.
Yeah, well, sometimes there are some grey areas there, like, for instance, you know, putting ads next to torrent links and things like that. I've come across this issue a lot with Creative Commons as well. You know, when people put Creative Commons on something and say, no commercial use allowed, and then the question becomes, well, you know, if you've got Google AdWords on your site where you're providing a download link to something, you know, is that commercial exploitation? So, you know, there are definitely issues to cover there. But, I mean, separately, you know, even just that that thing that you mentioned about anything that could be misconstrued as a, you know, a negative for US corporate profits, you know, that governments would have to pay compensation. I mean, that feeds into it as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess it could.
The MPAA can just stand up and say, you know, this or that infringing website, or, you know, even this individual, you know, is you know, negatively impacting our profits, so, you know, your government has to pay.
Yeah, I think that would probably just relate to government policy, like if they're changing the law. But
yeah.
With the actual criminal liability, that where websites and advertising, that's not what they're actually talking about there. The way it's worded, it includes people who just post data, who, you know, link off those sites, like, you know, click those links and download them.
Right.
If you're hosting the data that you download, that puts you in a position where you're hosting.
Right, because presumably someone's paying for that hosting, and so you're making a commercial profit by having someone pay to rent that server where those infringing files are sitting.
I'd have to look up the exact wording of it, but yeah. Sort of like that.
It's all, you know, it's difficult.
Yeah, that's also with that they want to have prison terms for criminal file sharing, and if all file sharing becomes criminalised, then that means it sort of criminalises everyone who shares any torrents.
Yes, And, you know, and that's the beginning of a police state, really, is to, you know, pass a law that criminalises everybody. And then it just becomes, you know, and then where it gets enforced becomes, you know, sort of a political hot potato.
Yeah, and then you see the issues in the UK at the moment with the owner of TV Shack being extradited to the US to... get tried for something that isn't actually illegal in the UK. Australia's recently passed laws relaxing our extradition treaties too, so something like that could easily become on the cards for any one of us, especially if the TPPA agreement gets passed, or TPP gets passed as the US would like it. The only sort of bright side to the entire thing is after the Melbourne round was said to have gotten absolutely nowhere and was an abysmal failure in terms of the IP chapter. So for people who actually support same health policy as our civil liberties. It was actually quite a successful meeting.
Yeah, well, that is good to hear. And I think on that positive note, we'll wrap it up. So thanks very much for coming on the webcast today.
Thanks, Simon.
Coming up next on the Pirate Party Australia webcast is a segment where I'll be reading from some of the most well-respected writers in pirate politics. Rather fittingly, we'll begin with the man who started the movement, Rick Folkfinger, and his excellent essay, The History of Copyright. This essay originally appeared as a 7-part series on Rick's blog at folkfinger.net. This reading is from the version printed in a book of essays on pirate politics called No Safe Harbour, that was recently released by the United States Pirate Party and is available for free download from nosafeharbour.com. History of Copyright by Rick Folkfinger. In this essay, I will look at the history of copyright from 1350 until the present day. The story of the history books differs quite strongly from what you usually hear from the copyright industry. We're starting with the advent of the Black Death in Western Europe in the 1350s. Like all other places, Europe was hit hard. People fled westward from the Byzantine Empire and brought with them both the plague and scientific writings. It would take Europe 150 years to recover politically, economically, and socially. The religious institutions were the ones to recover the slowest. Not only were they hit hard because of the dense congregation of monks and nuns, but they were also the last to be repopulated, as parents needed every available child in the family's economy, agriculture, etc. in the decades following the plague. This is relevant because monks and nuns were the ones making books in this time. When you wanted a book copied, you would go to a scribe at a monastery and they would copy it for you, by hand. No copy would be perfect. Every scribe would fix spelling and grammatical errors while making the copy, as well as introduce some new ones. Also, since all scribes were employed, read controlled, by the Catholic Church, there was quite some limitation to what books would be produced. Not only was the monetary cost of a single book astronomical, one copy of the Bible required 170 calf skins or 300 sheep skins, but there was also a limit to what teachings would be reproduced by a person of the clergy. Nothing contradicting the Vatican was even remotely conceivable. By 1450, the monasteries were still not repopulated, and the major cost of having a book copied was the services of the scribe, an undersupplied craft still in high demand. This puts things in proportion, given the astronomical cost of the raw materials and that they were a minor cost in ordering a book. In 1451, Gutenberg perfected the combination of the squeeze press, metal movable type, oil-based print inks, and block printing. At the same time, a new type of paper had been copied from the Chinese, a paper which was cheap to make and plentiful. This made scribecraft obsolete more or less overnight. The printing press revolutionized society by creating the ability to spread information cheaply, quickly, and accurately. The Catholic Church, which had previously controlled all information, and particularly held a cornered market on the scarcity of information, went on a rampage. They could no longer control what information would be reproduced, could no longer control what people knew, and lobbied kings across Europe for a ban on this technology, which wrested control of the populace from them. Many arguments were used to justify this effort, trying to win the hearts of the people for going back to the old order. One notable argument was, how will the monks get paid? The Catholic Church would eventually fail in this endeavour, paving the way for the Renaissance and the Protestant movement, but not before much blood had been spilled in trying to prevent the accurate, cheap, and quick distribution of ideas, knowledge, and culture. This attempt culminated in France on January 13, 1535, when a law was enacted at the request of the Catholic Church, a law which forced the closure of all bookshops and stipulated death penalty by hanging for anybody using a printing press. This law was utterly ineffective. Pirate print shops lined the country's borders like a pearl necklace, and pirate literature poured into France through contraband distribution channels built by ordinary people hungry for more things to read. On May 23, 1533, Mary was formally declared a bastard by the Archbishop. Her mother, Catherine, who was a Catholic and the Pope's protege, had been thrown out of the family by her father, Henry, who had turned Protestant just to get rid of Catherine. This was an injustice Mary would attempt to correct all her life. King Henry VIII wanted a son to inherit the throne of England for the Tudor dynasty, but his marriage was a disappointment. His wife, Catherine of Aragon, had only borne him a daughter, Mary, Worse still, the Pope would not let him divorce Catherine in the hope of finding someone else to bear him a son. Henry's solution was quite drastic, effective, and novel. He converted all of England into Protestantism, founding the Church of England in order to deny the Pope any influence over his marriage. Henry then had his marriage with Catherine of Aragon declared void on May 23, 1533, after which he went on to marry several other women in sequence. He had a second daughter with his second wife, and finally a son with his third wife. Unlike the bastard child Mary, her younger half-siblings, Elizabeth and Edward, were Protestants. Edward succeeded Henry VIII on the throne in 1547 at the age of 9. He died before reaching adult age. Mary was next in the line of succession, despite having been declared a bastard. Thus, the outcast ascended to the throne of England with a vengeance as Mary I in 1553. She had not spoken to her father for years and years. Rather, hers was the mission to undo her father's wrongdoings to the faith, to England and to her mother, and to turn England back into Catholicism. She persecuted Protestants relentlessly, publicly executing several hundred, earning her the nickname Bloody Mary. She shared the concern of the Catholic Church over the printing press. The public's ability to quickly distribute information en masse was dangerous to her ambitions to restore Catholicism, in particular their ability to distribute heretic material. Political material in this day and age was not distinguishable from religious material. Seeing how France had failed miserably in banning the printing press, even under threat of hanging, she realized another solution was needed, one that involved the printing industry in a way that would benefit them as well. She devised a monopoly where the London Printing Guild would get a complete monopoly on all printing in England, in exchange for her censors determining what was fit to print beforehand. It was a very lucrative monopoly for the Guild, who would be working hard to maintain the monopoly and the favour of the Queen's censors. This merger of corporate and governmental powers turned out to be effective in suppressing free speech and political religious dissent. The monopoly was awarded to the London Company of Stationers on May 4, 1557. It was called copyright. It was widely successful as a censorship instrument. Working with the industry to suppress free speech worked, in contrast to the French attempt in the earlier 1500s to ban all printing by decree. The stationers worked as a private censorship bureau, burning unlicensed books, impounding or destroying monopoly-infringing printing presses, and denying politically unsuitable material the light of day. Only in doubtful cases did they care to consult the Queen's censors for advice on what was allowed and what was not. Mostly it was quite apparent after a few initial consultations. There was obviously a lust for reading, and the monopoly was very lucrative for the stationers. As long as nothing politically destabilizing was in circulation, the common people were allowed their entertainment. It was a win-win for the repressive queen and for the stationers with a lucrative monopoly on their hands. Mary I died just 1 year later on November 17, 1558. She was succeeded by her Protestant half-sister Elizabeth, who went on to become Elizabeth I and one of the highest regarded regents of England ever. Mary's attempts to restore Catholicism to England had failed. Her invention of copyright, however, survives to this day. After Bloody Mary had enacted the copyright censorship monopoly in 1557, neither the profitable industry guild nor the censoring crown had any desire to abolish it. It would stand uninterrupted for 138 years. As we have seen, the copyright monopoly was instituted as a censorship mechanism by Mary I in 1557 to prevent people from discussing or disseminating Protestant material. Her successor, Elizabeth I, was just as happy to keep the monopoly after Mary's death in 1558 to prevent people from discussing or disseminating Catholic material. During the 1600s, Parliament gradually tried to wrestle control of the censorship from the Crown. In 1641, Parliament abolished the court where copyright cases had been tried, the infamous Star Chamber. In effect, this turned violation of the monopoly into a sentenceless crime, much like jaywalking in Sweden today. While it was still technically a crime and technically illegal, you could not be tried for it and there was no punishment. As a result, creativity in Britain soared into the stratosphere. Unfortunately, this wasn't what Parliament had had in mind at all. In 1643, the copyright censorship monopoly was reinstituted with a vengeance. It included demands for pre-registrations of author, printer, and publisher with the London Company of Stationers, a requirement for publication license before publishing anything, the right for the stationers to impound, burn, and destroy unlicensed equipment and books, and arrests and harsh punishments for anybody violating the copyright censorship. And we'll hear more of that gripping tale in the next episode, but for now, this brings our webcast to a close. I'll leave you with a quote from René Lemay, editor of the blog delimiter.com.au. When artists and consumers themselves get involved in the debate, a remarkable thing tends to happen. Self-interest largely disappears from the picture. Great art is never created from self-interest. It can only be created when an artist is driven by their creative impulse and applies discipline to develop their talents. The Pirate Party Australia webcast, including all music, is written, recorded and produced by Sam Kearns for Pirate Party Australia and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 Unported license. Thanks for listening.